BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Hello and welcome to this week's Dialect Radio. Come to you from the Bristol City Centre and is part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to our listeners in Preston and also in South America. Tonight we have an interview with Tim Elliott about China and Tibet, and we also hopefully should have Dougie D from FTP Radio, that's For the People. Part 3 of the Princess Diana interview and also a feature on Venezuela. And Malcolm Grieve continues with the history of the Mafia, and Jeff Sparks, of course, as always, is here with another What's On Guide. I'm John Peters-Coleman, presenter this week, and in the studio with me now is Tim Elliott to talk about China and Tibet. Good evening.
Hi there.
You are a campaigner for Amnesty International. What's your interest in Tibet at the moment?
My interest in Tibet is quite long-standing, really, but specifically in the moment, this week marks the 50th anniversary of the uprising against the Chinese occupation of Tibet and the subsequent exile of the Dalai Lama.
Okay. Aside from an obvious concern, if you're locked outside of Tibet, what can Amnesty International do to help people in Tibet?
Amnesty International can help support some of the UK-based Tibetan groups that do a lot of good work in organising supports, demonstrations and actions in this country, and help lobby their MPs, as what happened yesterday in the mass lobby of Parliament.
Okay. As a politically sort of independent group, what do you have any sort of particular stance on what should be going on in Tibet, or how do you approach Tibet if you're apolitical?
I think, as an organisation whose slogan is "Protect the Human," the basic and fundamental human rights issues are a key, and that's why Amnesty International was involved in Tibet. The human rights issues and abuses in that country are really terrible and fall far short of the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights.
What is your personal interest in Tibet that's led you to specifically target this as something that you want to help with?
I have an interest in the Dalai Lama specifically, in his philosophical thoughts and his general interest and concern with the well-being of every human on the planet. And despite him being a political leader and also a spiritual leader, he's a-religious. He really just wants to develop a sense of brotherhood and sisterhood around the world, and he's just incredibly compassionate for every human that he meets.
Have you ever met him?
I haven't met him. I went to see him talk at the Royal Albert Hall last year. That was a very, very interesting and enlightening experience. He was giving a talk on universal responsibility and brotherhood and sisterhood. And something that really struck me about that particular talk was when he said that every morning he gets up early in the morning and brings into mind the Chinese leaders and just has unending compassion for them. And if he can have unending compassion for them and try to and still maintain that drive to help the Tibetan people and not get disillusioned by the whole thing, then that's a very, very worthwhile stance to take. I have a lot of respect for him.
Yeah, particularly interesting to note in the papers on Wednesday, he said that Tibet is now a living hell, courtesy of what China are doing. Didn't they promise that in the run-up to the Olympics they were going to improve their human rights?
That's right. In the years sort of leading up to the bid for the Olympics, they they promised, they committed themselves to many, many actions to improve human rights in China. And part of the one of the campaigns Amnesty runs, and that I'm also involved with, is a human rights in China campaign. And what we've done recently is we've asked, have some of these issues been resolved? And, for example, has the Chinese authorities reduced the number of crimes punishable by the death penalty?
Mm-hmm.
No, there's still 68 offences punishable by death in China. Have the Chinese authorities published the number of executions carried out annually? No, they haven't published any data at all. And there's supposed to be about 6,000 secret executions in China every year. And that is by far the large number in any other country around the world. Have the Chinese authorities provided access and information to families and lawyers of those facing the death penalty? Access information that is absolutely sort of taken and a given in a country like ours or America? No, they are still refused info and access. Have the Chinese authorities ensured fair trials and an end to detention without trial? No, there is still punitive detention without trial in China. Have the Chinese authorities abolished re-education through labour and enforced drug rehabilitation programmes? No, thousands are still in re-education through labour programmes, mainly critics of the government.
Yep.
And followers of banned beliefs. And finally, have the Chinese authorities started to respect the rights of human rights defenders? No. The crackdown on human rights activists has actually intensified over the last couple of years, and there are still many people being detained and not given a fair trial.
Okay, so if your interest in Tibet is being expressed through highlighting human rights in China, are Amnesty International doing anything actively within China?
I don't think they're doing anything actively in China, and the level of awareness of human rights actually inside China is very, very poor. There's actually only one human rights post in the British Embassy in Beijing. One person. And that's to look after, to represent the UK's interests or in human rights in that country. And it is a very bad situation. What Amnesty try to do informally is support all the movements of the demonstrations and the protests that happen, that are supported by the sort of the UK-based groups, like lobbying our MPs in Parliament, like happened yesterday.
Okay, well, give us an example of what happened yesterday, your mass lobby of Parliament.
Okay, well, we went up to Parliament to have an appointment to see my local MP, Stephen Williamson, and we met about 100 to 150 other people up there, Tibetans included, and we all went into Westminster to House of Commons to lobby our MPs. And there were four things that we were calling for. There were four asks, really, of this campaign. Firstly, it was to call on the government to sponsor a thorough and independent inquiry into the excessive use of force, including against peaceful demonstrators,
yep,
in Tibet last year, in 2008. Secondly, to sign the tabled early day motion, the 50th anniversary of the 10th of March 2009 of the Tibetan uprising. And if one wants to read the whole early day motion, one can go to the UK Parliament website, and it's early day motion 978. And so far, 38 of our MPs have signed the motion, which is really, really good.
Okay, so you hope by campaigning and lobbying towards Parliament that the British government will change its position and try and put,
yep,
pressure on that way. Okay,
we really do. And the third and the fourth ask here, which I think are really important and ones that could actually get some action from the government, is to call the government to appoint a UK special representative to Tibet.
Okay.
The European Parliament have a special representative, and so do the American government, but we don't. And fourthly, to establish a Tibet desk at the British Embassy.
Okay, well, press freedom is obviously quite low in China, but of course we've always got the internet as well, of course. What can Amnesty International do to support that, and what are you doing?
Press freedom. The issue of press freedom is very difficult, actually, in Tibet. the media are heavily restricted. Mm. I think there's literally a few groups that are heavily escorted, and that's literally it. There's a crackdown on the use of internet and a crackdown on the use of mobile phones as well. To overcome that situation in Tibet, it would take a government sort of intervention and a lot of national lobbying. Amnesty can help do that by lobbying, by getting members to lobby their MPs and take part in campaigns as organised over the last couple of weeks.
Are international or foreign journalists being allowed into Tibet at all as of now, do you know?
As I said, a very limited number, and they are heavily escorted, and their content is very, very much restricted. And it's the same in China as well. I mean, it's much to a much greater extent in Tibet, but in China, foreign journalists are monitored, and they cannot report on issues that the government deem sensitive. So sort of national security or whatever, and the journalists inside China are heavily restricted in what they can report on.
If it's so, it seems like such an intractable and complex problem to try and break, what do you have much hope that anything will much change, or do you kind of feel Amnesty International is really quite sort of powerless to be able to really change anything?
I think some things, you do see some changes. You do see some political prisoners in Tibet and China being released. Our letter-writing campaigns are well known to be effective in many cases, and on a national level, on a political level, one can only hope that the human rights issues in Tibet are alleviated somewhat. And
okay, if people want to contact somebody to get in touch with the Bristol branch, lastly, how can they get in touch and help?
Yes, one can. Contact Christine Campbell. Mm-hmm. She is our group secretary on 0117 924 8138, or if anyone wants to find any more information about the Bristol group, they can Google Amnesty International and Bristol.
Okay, Bristol specifically. Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Tim Mallier, and we'll repeat that number at the end of the show, and thank you very much for coming in and talking to us.
Thank you very much, Jess.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
I'd like to welcome into the studio now Doug. Hi, Doug.
How are you doing?
You are a contributor, organiser of FTP Radio, For the People.
Yes, I was, yes.
You were?
Yeah, back when it was a moving force in Bristol. A strong sound in Bristol. Yeah, I was one of the main presenters and the main members of the station.
Okay.
And obviously that's what contributed, you know, along with all the other presenters, that contributed to being quite a major force in Bristol at the time.
Okay. How long ago were we talking? When did...
Oh, my God, now you're asking me to use my memory. We're talking probably about 18 years ago now, isn't it? Something like that. I'm not sure.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
Were you on you were a force on FM radio?
Yeah, we was. At the time, FTP, as far as pirate radio stations are concerned, there was about four different pirate radio stations. We were the top dog, so to speak. You know, we were the ones that were presenting the best music and presenting the best styles of music and what English music or English R&B and soul and reggae music was about, as well as music from around the world. We were presenting, you know, and representing basically for everybody.
So your other competitors, if would have been Passion, I guess, were they?
No, nothing from Passion was around then. It was all like Black FM and Power FM, and there was a fair few others, but no, Passion was just about thought about.
Okay, what were the relationships between these four pirate stations like? Were you sort of fairly
competitive? Very competitive. Yeah. I mean, it was all friendly, but we were, you know. We're really about trying to be the best DJs possible. You know, we didn't just do it just for the love. We did it. We were very competitive about our music and very passionate about what we did and how we presented our music. And it was a case of who can get to the shop and get the first imports, because back then it was all about imported records and you know, and CDs were never played. It was all vinyl. So we would, you know, we'd run to the shop as soon as, you know, on a Tuesday. We knew, you know, somewhere like Soundville Records. Go there on a Tuesday morning, George, Where's the seat? Where's the vinyl? And, you know, he'd come out and go to the imports and get them from America. And we'd grab them as fast as we could and get down and get to the radio station and play them. And, you know.
Okay. Well, how many people do you know listen to you at your peak? How much of an influence did you have?
I mean, before we became legal, I mean, we was talking 40-odd thousand people was listening to that radio station as a pirate radio station.
How long were you a pirate before you became legal then?
7 years at least.
So what happened for you in order to become legal? What does that mean in terms of your operation? What happened?
Going from being pirate to being legal, the transformation, although exciting, was not a good one, really. It really, the old, it was kind of like the time elapsing to going into it. We had to come off air, and as DJs, we became a bit rusty, I guess, you know, that's the way of looking at it. But once we went back on air, it wasn't the same feeling. It was kind of like we'd gone from being into this kind of like nice space to being into this kind of clinical surroundings, which we weren't used to as DJs. We liked it rough and ready.
So you moved offices and...
Yeah, the whole thing shifted and we went right uphill and up the scale, so to speak. But to me, it made the whole environment not what it used to be, you know? I mean, we used to go to the studio, we used to be like a house somewhere with a bedroom, with ripped wallpapers and posters stuck on the wall, you know, of all sorts. And we'd have beer cans in the corner and we all getting drunk and you know, we had a good time on air. And going into this legal scenario, we kind of lost that kind of being able to party and have a good time on air. So, it became a bit more official, you know.
Okay. How did you feel advertising affected the sound of your show? Did you have to sort of have lots of ad breaks? And
Advertisement is always part of radio anyway. That's how radio stations exist, whether they're pirates or legal. You have to have advertisement. And that didn't really affect us, but...
How do you operate getting advertising if you're effectively illegal?
Well, you're a community radio station, so community businesses would advertise on your station.
Okay.
Like, you know, hairdressers and butchers and local to the area or where we're broadcasting. People who put on events, they would advertise on the radio. So that's helped us to pay our rent and keep the equipment up, et cetera, et cetera, so...
Do you feel you were able to not only play records that are made by local Bristol people, but you were able to sort of actively support it and lift the local music scene to a high level through your radio station? What did you contribute to the
community? As far as I'm concerned, radio stations at those areas and that era were the major contributions to artists becoming known in their environment. Without the radio stations pushing and presenting their stuff, they really didn't get any voice into, you know, a voice to speak for them, etc., for them to go further. So we, as stations, really pushed those artists as much as possible. We'd have playlists and play their release singles, whether they're from Bristol or London or wherever. We'd play them every hour on the radio and call them power plays and stuff like that. So we were very, you know, very proactive to making sure that the artists were pushed on the station.
As a veteran of pirate radio, do you think the scene is as good now as it was? What do you think about local radio stations?
I think they're good. I mean, there's times have changed. I mean, more information is more important. Back then, it wasn't the information that was really important. It was the music that was a lot more important to people because it was an era where music and fun went hand in hand. Now, music and information is important because it's a lot of rubbish going on in life now. So people need to know more about it. So it's good to have informative shows and shows that speak about what's going on, whether it's locally or worldwide. I think that's really good. But I do feel trying to make that mix happen isn't happening very well with the community stations in the sense of making music and information go together properly.
What do you make of BCFM? I mean, they're a local legal community station. What do you make of their efforts?
I believe any station that's making any effort to communicate with the local community is you know, I got my hats off to them because as far as I'm concerned, it's an uphill struggle all the time trying to provide information for your local community. You know, that's something that seems to be a no-no as far as the radio authorities are concerned. They don't really take in consideration what the communities and the areas are in individual areas for these stations need. And obviously the communities themselves are looking for information about what's going on around in their local neighbourhood, as well as the fact that people from all around the world settle in different parts of the world and countries and cities, etc. And we want to know what's going on in our where we come from as well. So, you know, which is directly affecting us. Where I'm from, I'm Jamaican descendant, so I want to know what's going on in my, in, you know, where I, where my mum comes from, where she lives and stuff.
Do you feel the Jamaican community is adequately provided for? In,
Absolutely not. No, not at all. Not at all. I think the pirate radio stations, the pirate radio stations as they operate today, are, you know, strangely enough, still doing the same old thing. They're all about music. The community stations, the more licensed stations, they tend to have more information, but not geared up for what I believe the multicultural mixture that we have in Bristol, especially in Bristol.
What pirate stations do you know of that you listen to that, you know, what are you a pick of?
Well, Passion FM is the main dealer right now.
Are you contributing to them?
No, not at all.
No. Are you involved in sort of pirate radio yourself now?
I was up to about 2 years ago. In fact, I was sort of involved in running my own station, which was called BS1 Radio. But I find the politics involved with working with certain DJs made it very difficult, so I kind of stepped out of that.
Okay, are you thinking about getting back involved?
I am, actually.
Yeah, what are your plans?
If I was to get back involved, I would be more internet-based, I think, because...
Do you think there's a bigger listenership?
I think if it's promoted and marketed right, it can be done right, I mean, it's you know, once when we was on as BS1, we did have quite a good internet following, because obviously we was getting... You can tell how many people's listening to, etc. And we was getting, you know, people bought, going online from as far as America and Jamaica. And
how big was your listenership, do you know, roughly?
Well, I wouldn't know. I honestly wouldn't know. But to be honest, it was quite large. I mean, we would have like 60, 70 people. The problem is at the time, the technology we was using, you couldn't have too many people online, unless the stream would start to filter out and it would get all, you know, people would start getting bits of music rather than the full thing. So... It wasn't, you couldn't have too many people online, but we did get to a stage where it got really.
How many
really good.
Music has become a lot more commercialised as the decades have gone on. How do you think that's going to affect doing pirate radio now? Do you think as many local artists are going to get through as did? Do you think more people are getting involved and they're making a more commercial sound, or
commercial music? I mean, commercial music. The only thing I could say that England's contributing on, you know, if I'm going to put it from like a drum and bass or garage scene, if we're looking at that scene is a market that is kind of in its own field. They have got its own support. But outside of its own support, it's not going to go much further. It's not going to go like to America or Japan. I don't see that scene expanding, because it is sort of a British feel to the music, and it's stuck there in that groove. As far as live music is concerned, I mean, pirate radio stations don't really get involved too much in promoting live bands and live scene. Back in the day they did, but not so much now.
Do you think that's, but you missed that?
Yeah, I think live music is great. I mean, I think the venues for the live music in Bristol isn't very good. There isn't a lot of venues here to promote and for live bands to go to and promote their thing. But yeah, I think I like that scene, and back in the day the scene was heavy, it was really good. You'd be able to Trinity, different places, and hear that music, and it would be promoted.
All right, well, thank you very much for coming in, Doug. People are listening to pirate radio, what's do you have a sort of a DJ name that you go by?
If you ever hear me on, if I ever go on, it'd be Dougie D. But I played sort of the R&B and the old school soul classics, so that's what I do.
All right, well, thank you very much for coming on.
Very
keep
welcome.
It real, and best of luck for the future.
And you take it easy.
Before we move on, we've had a press release put out today, handed to me by Tony Gosling just before the show started. The Viva Palestina email alert that was given out today. At 1700 hours, so this is hot off the news, hot off the press. It is mission accomplished. You'll remember that Mohammed al-Haddad, who came into the studio 2 to 3 weeks ago, was going off in a convoy of 120 vehicles that left London, who were going to make their way across the infamous Rafah crossing to head into Palestine to give aid. And they have arrived. As I say, 120 vehicles left London, and 300 have arrived at the other end, so they've gained a few people en route. I don't know how many people that is. And there may be a lot of other people that have also made their way outside of vehicles as well, perhaps. But I'll just read you a few snippets from the press release. It says, "Mission accomplished, for now. Many were in tears, some of them inconsolable at having to leave their newfound family. Today, a large number of convoy members and activists who joined them in Gaza made their way to the infamous Rafah crossing to leave Palestine and head home. George Galloway, on leaving, described the destruction as unbelievable and a siege of medieval proportions. Prime Minister Hanya handed George Galloway his personal Prime Minister's passport as a symbolic gesture of gratitude and appreciation for his stance with the Palestinian people. About 20 stayed behind today on Wednesday to tour the area and meet with various bodies and officials in order to assess and evaluate the urgent needs of the Gaza population. Talat Ali, the only convoy leader who decided to stay behind, visited an orphanage housing between 100 to 150 orphans and listened to some harrowing accounts of the slaughter. Some children are so traumatised after spending days and nights under the rubble of their demolished homes with the bodies of their parents that they are simply unable to speak. The Viva Palestina members also visited an area where tents were erected to house the destitute who lost their homes. Each tent has a capacity of between 10 to 15 people. And in the extreme weather conditions they're experiencing, whole families sleep on the hard ground and struggle to keep themselves warm in the freezing nights. Last night, predictably, F-16s bombed Gaza again, making martyrs of 8 souls. And an activist told them that one of the bombs exploded only 200 yards from where they were sleeping. And she said, "I went back to sleep." That is the measure of Viva Palestina and the measure of the people of Gaza, who daily say to Israel, "Your bombs do not scare us and they will never defeat us." And that was prepared and translated by Farid Arada. Thank you very much to Viva Palestina for getting that email alert to us. And congratulations for now. On a slightly lighter note, or not perhaps, it's the history of the Mafia. It's time for the actor Malcolm Grieve to release another episode. And this week we hear about the Cray Twins.
The History of Organised Crime by David Southwell. The two men who would eventually claim the top title in English organised crime were Jack Spot and Billy Hill. Like many professional criminals, Jacob Collamore had more names than most men have suits: Jacob Camacho, John Comer, Jack Corner, and the name by which he became an English gangland legend, Jack Spot, self-proclaimed king of the underworld. Born in 1912 to Polish immigrants living in Whitechapel, the nickname Spot came not, as he later claimed, from being there whenever there was a spot of trouble that needed sorting out, but from the mole on his left cheek. By the age of 15, he was running protection rackets and preying on the Jewish stallholders in London's Petticoat Lane market. By 18, with a gang around him, he saw off rivals of the illegal bookmaking rackets and declared himself king of Aldgate. He continued to build his empire and became a local hero when he led the attack against Oswald Mosley's fascist blackshirts when they marched against Jews in London's East End in 1936. Spot was sentenced to 6 months in prison for assault on a blackshirt, and this proved to be the only time the police managed to put him away. It was said that he saw his prison sentence as a badge of pride, an underworld medal for standing up to fascists. It was, however, the only medal Spot did receive for standing up to the jackboots that were marching across Europe at the time. He, like many of his colleagues and rivals in organised crime, did everything within their power to ensure that they were not called up to fight for their country during the Second World War. Instead, Spot was one of the hundreds of villains who made vast fortunes from the black market and the range of criminal opportunities that opened up while the majority of the established police force was away fighting. In Spot's case, this included the theft of 100,000 ration books worth more than £500,000. In the aftermath of the Second World War, England's underworld was awash with weapons and men who had been trained to fight. Bolstering the ranks of his Aldgate gang from these men, Spot went to war with the White family, who had taken over the racetrack rackets from the Sabinis. In 1947, a climactic battle involving more than 100 men armed with coshes, razors, knives and guns was won by Spot's mob, and he declared himself king of the underworld. The other gang leader who had enjoyed a profitable war due to the black market and organised thieving was Billy Hill. Born at the Seven Dials near Leicester Square, he grew up in Camden, one of 21 children. His family already had a criminal reputation. His sister Maggie was Queen of the 40 Elephants, London's most notorious gang of female shoplifters. Hill also went to war with the White family to gain control of the racecourse and London club action. With the likes of the vicious fighter and thief Mad Frankie Fraser at his side, he too had the Whites on the run in 1947. Hill was soon calling himself the boss of Britain's underworld, but instead of going up against the self-proclaimed king, Hill formed an alliance with Spot that saw them share control. The profitable Hill-Spot axis was not destined to last, and in 1955 a feud between the two men spilled out into bloody confrontation. Spot knifed one of Hill's associates, the respected Italian-Scottish gangster Albert Dimes, on a street corner in Soho, and Dimes fought back, badly slashing Spot. Open gang warfare broke out. Spot bribed Parson Basil Andrews into giving evidence that freed him from police charges, only to receive vengeance from Hill in the shape of an attack by Frankie Fraser in 1956, who attempted to carve a noughts and crosses pattern on Spot's face. When a few months later Spot's nightclub, the Highball, was burnt down, he threw in the towel and retired from the scene. Hill's reign as undisputed king did not last long, however. His courting of publicity had earned him constant police attention, and new gangs, notably the Krays, were on the up. Rather than face the same fate as Jack Spot, in 1957 Hill announced his retirement from crime and went to live in Spain, where he died in 1984. More than 50 years after he retired, underworld king Billy Hill is still considered by many English gangsters as a criminal mastermind. This reputation rests not just on putting together his organised crime network, or pulling off such heists as the £287,000 East Castle Street mailbag robbery in 1952. It persists because he was smart enough to avoid confronting a violent new breed of criminal, symbolised by the Cray twins, who would have challenged him for his crown. Identical twins Ronald and Reginald Cray were born in 1933 to a classic East End family of somewhat legally shady characters, Petticoat Lane market stallholders and boxers. Despite the matriarchal grip of their mother Violet on the family home in Bethnal Green, by the time the boys were 17, their reputation for violence was not limited to their official jobs as professional boxers. In 1954, the boys took over a run-down snooker hall called the Regal off the Mile End Road in Whitechapel. A gang of Maltese extortionists was plaguing it, but the twins saw them off in a bloody confrontation involving cutlasses. Within a year, their underworld standing had grown, as had their illegitimate business empire. By 1956, the Krays were heading a gang they called The Firm, were considered valued associates of Jack Spot, and had control of unlicensed gambling clubs and bookies across a swathe of East London. They also began to enforce the collection of tax on illicit profits made by any criminal operating on their patch. Seen by many as the natural successors to Jack Spot, many believed it would only be a matter of time before the Krays went up against Hill. But his resignation in 1957 as boss of the underworld avoided the need for any conflict. Instead, the twins began to expand into the power vacuum created by Hill's abdication, especially in London's West End clubland, where in 1960 they forced businessman Stephen DeFay to sell them his interest in the Knightsbridge gambling club Esmeralda's Barn for £1,000. Between long, firm frauds, receiving protection money from more than a third of London's illegal gambling clubs, and taxing fellow criminals, the brothers were wealthy enough to be treated as equals by the celebrities and politicians they mixed with. They were also easily able to afford to pay the ever-increasing number of members of the firm. Alliances were made with gangs in Glasgow. Clubs in Birmingham were taken over, and they even began to court the American Mafia. By the mid-1960s, things could have been gloriously easy for the Krays. They ruled the East End, and were treated like celebrities in the West End. Their main gangland rivals, the Richardsons, had been jailed, and the police always met with a wall of silence when inquiring after them. Even the press were too afraid to tackle them after the Daily Mirror newspaper was forced to offer an unqualified apology for a story it ran linking them to the politician Lord Boothby. However, the empire of violence and fear they had built contained an inherent weakness. Ronnie Cray, the self-styled colonel, who modelled himself and his outfit on the 1930s American gangster films he loved. When Ronnie was imprisoned for grievous bodily harm in 1957, he was diagnosed as a paranoid schizophrenic and declared insane. While this is not always a handicap in a criminal career, as the years went by, his strange behaviour grew to the point where it threatened the firm. In 1966, his personal love of violence saw Ronnie execute Richardson gang member George Cornell by shooting him in the head while he was drinking at the Blind Beggar pub. Cornell had called him a fat puff. He then egged on his twin Reggie to kill Jack the Hat McVitie in September 1967. By this point, some members of the firm were so worried about Ronnie's irrational behaviour, they began making plans to assassinate him. Loyalty to the twins began to crumble, and so did the fear they generated. In 1968, their long-time police nemesis, Inspector Leonard Nipper Reed, was able to secure witnesses. The twins were sentenced to life imprisonment, with a judge recommending that they serve at least 30 years for the killings of Cornell and McVitie. The self-mythologizing of Ronnie, the courting of publicity and unnecessary violence all played a part in ensuring that Ronnie died behind bars on March 17, 1995. And Reggie saw only 36 days of freedom before his death on October 1, 2000.
Thank you to the actor Malcolm Gree for reading us another part of the history of the Mafia. More next week. The inquest into Princess Diana's tragic death took more than 10 years to happen, and even then left many questions unanswered. We heard about some of them last week we had such a busy show we didn't have time for it. But we heard an extract from the Martin Bashir interview with Princess Diana the week before last and the week before that. It was watched back in 1995, just 2 years before she died, by Panorama's biggest ever television audience, and has never been heard since. It's never been repeated. This week is part three. We split it into seven parts. Press reports of difficulties in the royal marriage begin to emerge.
According to reports in the national press, it was at around this time that you began to experience difficulties in your marriage and your relationship to the Prince of Wales. Mm. Is that true?
Well, we were a newly married couple, so obviously we had those pressures too. And we had the media, who were completely fascinated by everything we did. And it was difficult to share that load, because I was the one who was always pitched out front, whether it was my clothes, what I said, what my hair was doing, everything. It was a pretty dull subject, actually, and it's been exhausted over the years. When actually what we wanted to be, what we wanted to support, it was our work and as a team.
What effect did the press interest in you have on your marriage?
It made it very difficult, because for a situation where it was a couple working in the same job, we got out the same car, shook the same hand, my husband did the speeches, I did the handshaking. So basically we were a married couple doing the same job, which is very difficult for anyone. And more so if you've got all the attention on you. We struggled a bit with it. It was very difficult. And then my husband decided that we'd do separate engagements, which was a bit sad for me, because I quite liked the company. But there again, I didn't have the choice.
So it wasn't at your request that you did that on your own?
Not at all, no.
The biography of the Prince of Wales, written by Jonathan Dimbleby, which, as you know, was published last year, suggested that you and your husband had very different outlooks, very different interests. Would you agree with that?
No. I think we had a great deal of interest. We both liked people, both liked country life, both loved children, work in the cancer field, work in hospices. But I was portrayed in the media at that time, if I remember rightly, as someone, because I hadn't passed any O-levels and taken any A-levels, I was stupid. And I made the grave mistake once of saying to a child I was thick as a plank in order to ease the child's nervousness, of which it did. But that headline went all around the world, and I rather regret saying it.
The Prince of Wales, in the biography, is described as a great thinker, a man with a tremendous range of interests. What did he think of your interests?
Well, I don't think I was allowed to have any. I think that I've always been the 18-year-old girl he got engaged to, so I don't think I've been given any credit for growth. And my goodness, I've had to grow.
Explain what you mean when you say that.
Well,
when you say you were never given any credit, what do you mean?
Well, anything good I ever did, nobody ever said a thing, never said well done or was it okay. But if I tripped up, which invariably I did, because I was new at the game, a ton of bricks came down on me.
How did you cope with that?
Well, obviously there are lots of tears, and one could dive into the bulimia and to escape.
Some people would find that difficult to believe, that you were left so much to cope on your own, and that the description you give suggests that your relationship with your husband was not very good even at that early stage.
Well, we had unique pressures put upon us, and we both tried our hardest to cover them up, but obviously it wasn't to be.
Around 1986, again according to the biography written by Jonathan Dimbleby about your husband, he says that your husband renewed his relationship with Mrs. Camilla Parker Bowles. Were you aware of that?
Yes, I was. But I wasn't in a position to do anything about it.
What evidence did you have that their relationship was continuing even though you were married?
A woman's instinct is a very good one.
Is that all?
Well, I had knowledge of it.
From staff?
Well, from people who minded and cared about our marriage, yes.
What effect did that have on you?
Pretty devastating. Rampant bulimia, if you can have rampant bulimia, and just a feeling of being no good at anything and being useless and hopeless and failed in every direction. Wow.
And with a husband who was having a relationship with somebody else?
Was a husband who loved someone else, yes.
You really thought that?
Mm-hmm. I didn't think that, I knew it.
How did you know it?
By the change of behavioural pattern in my husband, for all sorts of reasons that a woman's instinct produces. You just know. It was already difficult, but it became increasingly difficult.
In a practical sense, how did it become difficult?
Well, people were... When I say people, I mean friends on my husband's side were indicating that I was, again, unstable, sick, and should be put in a home of some sort in order to get better. I was almost an embarrassment.
Do you think he really thought that?
Well, there's no better way to dismantle a personality than to isolate it.
So you were isolated?
Mm-hmm. Very much so.
Do you think Mrs. Parker Bowles was a factor in the breakdown of your marriage?
Well, there were three of us in this marriage, so it was a bit crowded.
That was part three of Princess Diana, Queen of Hearts, where the Panorama BBC programme interviewer was Martin Bashir. Part four next week is around the 1987 period. In public, the royal couple continued their duties, but it proved impossible to lead a double life. And as a passing fact, Diana was also a local lass for a while, spending a lot of time just north of Bristol at Prince Charles's pad in Highgrove, which is just past Weston Burt on the A433 near Tedbury. Recently, the BBC reported in the news the story of a British couple who had been arrested by the police in Venezuela and charged with being in possession of drugs. Our intrepid reporter Anthea Page, on her recent trip to South America, interviewed Arthur, who is a Portuguese citizen living in Bariloche in Argentina, and talked about his experiences with the police in that country.
Of my adventure last time I was in Venezuela, Caracas. And that happened in 2008, January 2008. I was leaving from Caracas to London. And when I got into the airport, international airport, McTier. Usually when you leave from the airport, they search you. What they did before I did my check-in, they called me. They searched my luggage for drugs. After that, they didn't find anything else. They sealed my luggage with a plastic, and then I had to do the check-in straight away. I've done that. Then I left to go to the border to pass the immigration people. While I was waiting there, a military called me and asked me if I would mind to be searched. I said, no, it's okay, there's no problem at all. I'm confident I don't have nothing, so I agree to do that, because you never know. If you say no, you never know what's going to happen, because they have the power and that's it. So,
were you scared then?
No, at the time I wasn't scared. I felt comfortable. So they took me to the office, to the military office inside at the airport. And then when we arrived there, they asked me to wait. And I was waiting there for a few minutes, more than 15 minutes at least. And the militaries there, the ones who were in the same room with me, they start to say things, you know, like, there's another one guy, we got him. Definitely he might have something.
Mm-hmm. That's like intimidation.
Yeah, I was scared because I've been in the military and I know how to behave with them, especially with this kind of people. So after 15 minutes, that military was with me, came, asked me to go with him, to follow him outside to the airport. So I did follow him. We went through to the main entrance at the airport and straight to a military car. Once there, he spoke with the driver and another military, and they passed me, like, you know, take this guy.
Were they armed in the car?
Yeah, always. They're always armed. In the car or outside of the car, they're always armed. They asked me to go into the car. I went into the car. When I'm sitting down, a civilian individual comes on my right side door, normal clothing. And once he's inside of the car, he does the Christ cross on his body. So I look at him.
Looking at you? What
he's
doing?
No, he did, you know, he was a bit concerned. Like, let's hope there's nothing here, you know, like that. Yeah, I look at him and said, wow, what's going on here? Okay, let's keep cool, quiet. And they start the car, and they start to leave the airport area straight to a small village on the mountains near to the airport. Caracas Airport is like a favela, it's a very poor neighborhood. For the beginning, they start to go up in the direction of the favelas.
But did they at any point tell you where they were going?
No, not at all.
No explanation?
No. At the time I was thinking, gosh, what they want from me? They want some money, but if I do that, you never know. So I said, no way. Let's be quiet, let's be calm, and let's see what's going on. After 20 minutes going through that small area, poor area, finally we got to a clinic. I didn't know, but we got to a clinic. They took me from the car to follow them.
They
between
didn't
them,
you then.
No. To be honest, no, they didn't. They didn't do that. I was with my computer bag on my shoulder. So then they took me to the ground, to the lower floors of the building. We went to a room where they asked me to take off my clothing, all of it. After that, I realized they want to take me an X-ray to my body to see if I was hiding anything, I was swallowed, I was put through my rectum. And they took the X-ray. After that, they made me wait outside. While I was outside, a lady, a Venezuelan lady, she was a doctor, she was working at the hospital, in a disgusting move with her head, she asked me what's going on and what time was my flight. I said, well, in one hour time. And she was so disgusting the way they were treating me, you know, like a bandit. And okay, so she couldn't do nothing and I couldn't do nothing. I just had to follow orders, that's it. After a while, they came back with the results of the x-ray. So, thanks God, I had nothing to hide. So everything was okay. They made me to sign some documents and print my fingerprints on a document, my both hands straight. They took me back to the airport, to the border, to the boarding room to board my flight, because in 20 minutes my flight would depart. So that was my story in my last time in Venezuela. I was a bit when they took me outside of the airport, yes. At that point, I was afraid, because you never know, they are militaries, and they can do whatever they want.
Yeah, do you have friends in Venezuela?
Yeah, I do
what
have friends.
What happens to people who are found with drugs?
Well, people who are found with drugs, they are taken to the jail, definitely.
With trial or no trial?
Not with trial. Afterwards, of course, they go to a trial, but before that, they spend a few weeks there without a trial.
And what's the sentence normally?
At least no less than 10 years.
And what are the conditions like?
Well, you can imagine. That's Latin America, you know, so really bad.
Yeah.
Really bad. You can be killed easily inside of those jails, especially in Caracas.
And what about, can people disappear?
As I used to say, Venezuela is a far west country, so they can do whatever they want with you and leave no trace. Daily kidnapping in a big cities like Caracas, Maracaibo, stuff like that.
That was Dialect's Anthea Page talking to Arthur on Bariloche about his experience with the police in Venezuela. Well, time was, Johnny Cash was the man in black, but since he's gone, we've got a replacement that we can offer you. He's hammered, according to his shirt. It's Jeff Sparks.
Thank you, John. Good evening. This is your What's On guide from Dialect Radio. Kicking off with Friday, 20th of March, and at the Rolleston, which is at Commercial Road in Swindon, acoustic folk rock duo I Am Three will be performing. The gig starts around 9 p.m. and entry is free. Also on 20th of March, and at the Prom Bar in Bristol, The Bridge will be performing. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £5 on the door. Moving on to Song of the Week, and when all else fails, you play the classics. This is Status Quo with Pictures of Matchstick Men from the album Pictures, 40 Years of Hits.
Thank you.
Status Quo with Pictures of Matchstick Men from the album Pictures, 40 Years of Hits. For more information, you can check out www.statusquo.co.uk. Moving on to Saturday, 21st of March, and at the Thekla in Bristol, Wilco Johnson will be performing with support from David Sinclair Trio. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £12 in advance. Also on 21st of March, and at the Thunderbolt in Bristol, The Exhibition will be performing. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £2 in advance and £3 on the door. Finally, on 21st of March and at the Reckless Engineer in Bristol, Goldfish Don't Bounce will be performing with Skin from First Element and Distilled Empathy on vocals. The gig starts around 9 p.m. and entry is free. On to Sunday, March 22nd and at the Fleece in Bristol, Nick Harper will be performing. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £10 in advance. Finally, on 22nd of March, and at the O2 Academy, formerly the Carlin Academy in Bristol, Il Nino will be performing with support from God Forbid and Sanctorum. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £12.50 in advance. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you very much, Jeff. I've got a couple of things to advertise on the back of that also. We spoke to Tim Elliott earlier from Amnesty International, and he's told given me this to read out to you, which I think is quite important, if you're interested. Paldon Gatso, survivor from the 1959 Tibetan uprising, who subsequently endured 33 years in Chinese prison and labour camps for his beliefs, is in Bristol this March with the film of his life story, which is called Fire Under the Snow. You can see this at the Watershed Cinema on Sunday the 15th of March at 1 p.m. And you are warmly invited to hear first-hand evidence from the man himself, Paldon Gatso, about life in Tibet. And also, you've got the opportunity to meet up with some of your local concerned constituents, which includes Kerry McCarthy, who is the parliamentary representative for Bristol East, and Stephen Williamson for Bristol West. You can also join them at 4:30 p.m. at the Pierian Centre, 27 Portland Square, St. Paul's, where on the same day, where there will be a light Tibetan buffet included. If you want to get in touch, you can ring Eugen Schofel on 0117 902 1484 or speak to anybody on that number, or 07854 111081, or you can email Eugen at thanker.co.uk. Obviously, I'm going to spell that. That's Eugen at thanger.co.uk. And if all of that is too much to take in, we'll stick it up on our website, dialectradio.co.uk. Also, on Monday the 16th at the Redland Reformed Church on White Ladies Road, Amnesty International are having their monthly meeting, and you can go along at 7:30 p.m. On Saturday the 21st of March at about 3 p.m. on the corner of Cambridge Road and Gloucester Road, the Resisting War Crime is Not a Crime. Jail the war makers, not the peacemakers. And you can support the EDO defendants. And if you're interested in that, check out www.decommissioners.wordpress.com. Well, that's it. That's the end of this week's Dialect Radio Show from the Bristol Radio Co-op, based here in the city centre. Our features were brought to us by Dialect Radio reporters Tony Gosling and Anthea Page. And Malcolm read another instalment of The History of the Mafia, and thank you very much to him for his excellent reading skills. Thank you to Tim Elliott once again for coming in, and Dougie D for coming in. Unfortunately, Rachel Webinson couldn't be with us, but we wish her well and get well soon. And The What's On was presented by Jeff Sparks. Phyllis Church-Curran was the studio engineer. We're hoping to get another member of Amnesty International in next week for another chat. This week's show was produced by Jeff Sparks. Download the show on the internet at dialectradio.co.uk, where we'll put details of all the phone numbers and stuff that you need to know. And if anybody wants to join us, send us an email, bristolradiocoop@hotmail.co.uk. It's goodbye from all of us here at Dialect Radio, and take very good care of yourselves. And until next week, goodbye.